This was the anticlimactic denouement to his whispered tornado story. Having been whisked through 4 miles of debris-cluttered sky, having been swallowed by the wrath of God, and been kept not just safe, but unbruised inside it. Having been awakened mid-morning in a fallow field by a face-licking retriever, Dad's response was to leave his prosperous track and plunge his hands joyfully into the sewer. An explanation is beyond me, other than to repeat what he would often say. The story ended, his hands tucking up the blankets. I was treated so gently up there, kids. But the whole thing bothered Davy, and with Dad out of earshot, he'd say so. You couldn't get blown around in a tornado, he said, and not get banged up. It didn't make sense. It wasn't right. Swede challenged him. Are you calling Dad a liar? Of course not. I know it happened. It just shouldn't have. Don't you see that? No, Swede replied. But I saw what he meant, or I would eventually. Davy wanted life to be something you did on your own. The whole idea of a protective fatherly God annoyed him. I would understand this better in years to come, but never subscribe to it, for I was weak and knew it. I hadn't the strength or the instincts of my immigrant forebears. The weak must bank on mercy, without which, after all, I wouldn't have lasted 15 minutes. History simply hadn't equipped me as it had Davy. You had only to look at his hands to see it. His hands were hard as any man's, and quick, quick as eyesight. They moved always as with a purpose long known. History was built into Davy so thoroughly he could never see how it owned him. And Mom, I can only believe she sat down and wept after that phone call, as any loving wife might do. How she must have rejoiced, how frantically she must have driven to the Evans farm. And the clasping and the shuddering of that reunion must have been a thing Mary Ann Evans would tell her neighbors about and remember in her heart on rainy evenings while her husband worked in the barn. Happily for Mary Ann, she would not see the changes that tornado wrought. She would not see my mother's puzzlement as Dad surrendered his studies and his prosperous future, nor my mother's attempts to make the best of it. These attempts lasted quite a while, really, long enough to bear Swede and me. But she must have felt Dad had violated some part of the covenant between them. She departed without explanation or epilogue. We heard later that she married a doctor, after all, in Chicago, an older gentleman whose first wife had died. We heard they patronized the symphony and the theater and enjoyed choice memberships. But none of this did we hear from Mother, for no letter or call did we once receive, nor did we ever meet the gentleman on whose behalf we'd been erased. They put Davy in cuffs and drove him to the Montrose jail and the rest of us to a motel for the night. Easing away through the rain, we saw an ambulance backed onto the lawn, a deputy stooped smoking on the porch, and the freeze and fade of windows struck with camera flash. The whole thing was no less a tornado than the other. Next day, when we went to see Davy, Swede tried to kick him. She was crying and incensed, and he reached to comfort her, and she gave it a stout try between the bars, only to clank her shin. "Good grief! It's lucky I'm in here," Davy remarked, as Swede hopped about, biting her lip. Grim as it was, I could see Dad was glad for the joke. Davy'd shaken off the concussed glaze of the night before. He was in a little cell, with tan lighting and squashed flies on the wall, but he'd not grown fangs or become a creature changed beyond knowing. When Swede had got the mat out and hugged Davy through the bars, Dad told us to say goodbye and wait for him in the hall. That was the hardest thing, going out that door. It was so thick and closed so heavily we couldn't eavesdrop through it, not even with the paper cup Swede swiped from the water cooler. Dad was quiet when he joined us. We walked out to the car, the wind flapping staleness off our clothes. "He seems all right, doesn't he?" I said. "Sure he does," Dad replied. It seemed a long ride home. We got there at supper time, and Swede and I looked around in the cupboards. Normally, Dad would have taken over and worked up some meal or other, or at least suggested that Swede and I do it, but instead he just sat in a kitchen chair and leaned back shut-eyed. Thinking of supper, I asked, "You want us to do anything, Dad?" "Persevere," he said. It was a better answer than we wanted. What else to do when the landscape changes? when all mirrors tilt. That first week, Swede rose as usual and demanded that I help her cook Dad's oatmeal, but he could no more eat it than he could wave and run for Congress. Suddenly, lots of people we didn't know were calling and dropping by. Reporters? Yes. An apologetic writer from the County Weekly in Montrose. A sad-mouth fellow from the Star in Minneapolis. Two different radio men, slump-shouldered from their big reel-to-reels. And the first TV correspondent ever cited locally, which merited an article and photo of its own in the Montrose Observer. We also heard from certain bold and ambitious lawyers who'd read the early accounts, and, for some reason, from a slew of young women who'd seen Davy's tragic mug in the news and imagined him misunderstood. Meantime, a lot of people we did know, and whose cheerful encouragement I'll bet Dad could have used, were staying away. A few examples? How about Harold Barkus, the gas and oil man who did all the repairs on our aging Plymouth, who once came to Dad drunk and weeping after his wife had left, and drooled a quart into our couch that night as he slept, and left next morning sober and galvanized, with a hot breakfast in him. Harold Barkus wouldn't even fill our gas tank anymore, instead sending his gangly boy out to do it. Through plate glass we could see Harold, sitting in his office, not looking out. How about Leroy Bierston, the principal of the school, who'd hired Dad, and who'd sat grieving at our table when his daughter turned up pregnant by a fled serviceman? Do you suppose Leroy could think of a word of comfort? Maybe it was fear, I don't know. Maybe embarrassment. Maybe these people put themselves in Dad's place, figuring they'd wish for no one to say a word if their son had shot down two boys. If it were their son sitting all day, all night in that courthouse cell. Or maybe, could this be? They just reasoned Dad was due some grief. That a man like him couldn't be exactly what he seemed. Perhaps it relieved their anxious souls that the clock ran against Jeremiah Land as it ran against them all. I think of Oscar Larson, who liked to take Dad fishing because it seemed the walleyes always gathered round when Dad was in the boat, and of Gary Sweet, the butcher, whose walk-in freezer Dad had fixed during the July hot spell the previous summer, saving the integrity of uncounted beeves. I think of Ron Simonson, the odd jobs man, who could count on Dad for occasional work, sharpening mower blades, shingling the garage, doing such tasks as Dad would have been delighted to do himself had Ron not needed employment. And I think, can't help it, of those friends of Job's in the Old Testament, the men who came to Job as he lay there in his bed of ashes, all twisted with boils and the loss of his children, and said to him, "Now what did you go and do?" Of course, vindictiveness is an ugly trait, and, yes, I do mean to forgive all these nice deserters. I mean, eventually, to say, to their ghosts, if not to their living faces, "It's all right, I understand. I might have done the same thing." Not yet, though. Let me bear witness first. Two men I remember who did not desert. No, three. They were the Methodist preacher, James Reach, and Dr. Animus Noakes, and also Mr. Layton, first name of Gerard, the dime store man who had been struck of the spirit at the hand of Reverend Johnny Ladd. Reach and Layton and Noakes. These three. Strangely, it was Dad who seemed to suffer most, and Dad whom these few rallied round, while Davy, who had aimed and fired, Davy sat suspended on a county bench and seemed, on the whole, the same boy who'd always been my favored brother. Though some thinner, he didn't eat much in there. I remember a moment when he rose from his seat against the cinder block and put his arms around me through the bars, and I put mine around his narrow waist. Then I saw how dark he was beneath his chin, and how his skin looked rough and loose like a much older man's. He grinned and wouldn't let me cry. "Say, Natty," his hands strong upon my shoulders, "don't you eat those geese yet? You keep those in the deep freeze till I get out, just a little while." At this I recall a stirring of the jailer, who stood close by, a fleeting chuckle of his keys, as if at Davy's words, "till I get out, a little while." But I held my eyes on Davy's and saw a thing that jailer couldn't. I saw the shine of certainty, of faith, of some knowledge inside my brother, and I knew in whom I could believe. But if Davy didn't get much reassurance in person, and you know, even Dolly didn't go see him, not right away, he surely did get it through the mail. Especially those first days, when the newspapers leaned graciously in his direction. Not the Montrose Observer, which still had the Finch and Bosca families to live beside, and so took an almost ludicrous care with the story, but the Minneapolis Daily's first few headlines were the stuff of scrapbooks. Teenage son defends home and family. Held without bail at 16. Davy Land jailed for shooting assailants. Davy's sister. He saved my life. This last was a triumph for the solemn fellow from the Star, who sat at a distance watching our house until Dad went into the backyard to rake. The reporter then sprinted to a phone booth, Clark Kent-like, dialed our number, and by pure good manners got a sentence or two out of Swede before Dad, hearing her voice through the screen windows, returned, rightfully suspicious. These stories lit fuses under an astonishing number of folks. They wrote letters as if impelled by nature, as if Davy embodied whatever it was they'd thought long lost and wanted back. Dear Davy Land, in this godless day of corrupt youth and permissiveness towards criminals, it is reassuring to see a young man stand up in defense of hearth and home. That you are reading this in jail is no surprise to me, but instead a sorrowful commentary on the way we treat those who dare to do what is right. Lest you begin to doubt yourself, let me reassure you. Those fellows who broke into your house were cast from evil molds. They had in mind to hurt and kill, and they reaped what they had thought to sow. Your bravery gives us all new hearts. Sincerely. Dear Davy, I'm a widow, young, whose good husband died 2 months before our house was broke into by a bad boy from the neighborhood. Often I have wondered what my husband would have done had he been here, and now I think I know. He was a strong man. He had eyes remindful of your own, as struck me when I saw your picture. I am sorry for you to be where you are right now, but am praying for you daily. Will there be a trial? I'm enclosing a recent photograph of myself. Warm regards. So many letters came in those first 2 weeks that one of the deputies, Walt Stockard, who'd managed to father 4 restive daughters before his 27th birthday, brought in a shoebox to hold them all. The shoebox was festooned with pink ribbons and all manner of brocade and peppermint swirls laid on with crayons, so that it looked like it ought to hold valentines. Every day, Stockard would replenish the box from that morning's post, and in slow hours would pull up a chair and prop his boots on the bars, dipping into the mail and reading aloud. Here's one from Maggie in St. Paul. Dear Davy, I'm in the 9th grade at Washington School. We have just begun to read William Shakespeare. Our teacher, Mrs. Willis, demands we read Julius Caesar, even though he knows it's Romeo and Juliet we all desire. I hope you will write back. I would like to have a pen pal. Maybe we could tell each other our thoughts. I'm only 14, but everyone says I'm mature for my age. And say, Davy, it's got perfume on it. None of this was comforting to Dad, however. There arrived a day when the phone budged into our dinner table quietude, informing us that Davy would be charged with 2 counts of manslaughter, that charge instead of murder because of Davy's age, and because the victims had entered the house bent on mischief. Mischief? Swede said. Mischief? I knew what she meant. Mischief was the word Dad used when we ventured into the timber with a hat full of firecrackers, meaning to explode cow pies. In fact, we were now beset with a whole lexicon of legal applesauce. Swede and I eavesdropped on a man in a beard and a tan baggy suit who sat at the table drinking the coffee Dad so tiredly poured, the two of them talking in quiet voices about jury selection and presumption of innocence and change of venue, this plea and that plea, bail reductions, and judicial prejudices against violent youth. Salient to me in the visit of the bearded man was not so much his language as his expression, which was wise, guarded, and unencouraged by encountered fact. Judge Raster lost his wife last summer, he told Dad. It has not made him soft. And from this grave disclosure I drew my picture of Judge Raster, a black-robed hulk, face like a shark's, noose clutched behind his back. The bearded man, Dad told us the next day, was Thomas de Cuellar. He was Davy's defense attorney, appointed by the state. We knew he was a good man because he was on our side and had 20 years' experience in various courts of law, and because he'd brought with him, from his wife, a quart jar of dill pickles she had put up herself, with cloves of bluish garlic and, Cuellar said, somewhere in there, a jalapeno pepper. Days came, went, Davy sat. Reporters left town in search of new misfortunes. The strange mail dropped off. One morning, Swede didn't come out of her room and foiled my snoopish concern by propping a chair beneath her doorknob. "I'm working," she declared. "Don't bother me." Her tight-throated resolve gave me new wells of unease to plumb. "Working on what? Isn't your business?" She was writing, of course. I could hear the whir of the typewriter carriage as she rolled in a sheet. The fact made me nervous in some abstruse way. What I wanted was for Swede to be Swede, that is, glad and happy and belonging to me, as usual. We'd always been an exclusive pair, she being smart enough for the two of us and never begrudging me her secrets. "Is it sunny sundown?" I asked, sounding, I know, like some dumb jealous boyfriend. But all the same, you should have heard the passion she was pouring on those keys. She didn't answer, so I moped away to the kitchen to eat cornflakes in solitude. Dad was back at work by now, having taken leave after the shootings, and by rights we ought to have been back in school. But Dad, though a believer in education, had never respected the glowing objective of perfect attendance, a goal set for kids, he said, by adults with ruined imaginations. Before returning to his job, he'd sat down with Swede and me and asked if we felt ready to undertake classes and sociability again, or whether we'd like another week at home. What do you think we were, idiots? Besides, I suspect Dad didn't want us back in school yet. He was weathering quite a gale there himself, though we didn't know it. Superintendent Holgren, first name of Chester, a man whose face was a minefield of red boils, had decided to scour that janitor's teeth. His precise words, as told to me later by the daughter of a school board member who'd invited heinous old Chester over for rolls and gossip. I will give you an example of such scouring. Remember how, the night Finch and Bosca broke in, the rain changed to snow? Well, it snowed 2 inches before changing back to rain the next morning, and the rain came cold and steady for some days thereafter, so that the gutters of roofing ran with brown water, and runoff from the railroad grade sated the yards of trackside residents, and the boulevard maples and elms grew rank and black, their limbs swooning. Had the city been more carefully engineered, had the storm sewers been of greater capacity, or the school been built on higher ground, this would have been harmless enough. And yet, on Saturday afternoon, 2 days before Dad returned to work, the sewer system came full. It was stuffed. Squatting on its low plot, the school became a living illustration of the properties of water, which, as you know, seeks its own level. How much detail do you need? How much can you stand? I'll spare you beyond saying that when Dad got to school Monday morning, he encountered a basement shin-deep in evil, a swamp of soft terrors afloat and submerged, a furnace choked and dead, a smell to poise your wits for flight. Superintendent Holgren called off school, of course. But do you think he called a plumber? The first 2 days, Dad didn't even come home. He telephoned to ask that I bring him a sandwich and a clean shirt. His voice betrayed the headache that had been riding him all week. When we reached the school, Dad met us at the top of the basement steps. His hands were clean, but you ought to have seen his clothes. He tried leading us away, but we looked past him and beheld what he was up against. Did you know that air can have a taste? "Where's Mr. Ringman?" Swede asked suspiciously. Mr. Ringman was second janitor, meaning he didn't have as many keys as Dad. "Well, he left." "Couldn't you come home?" I asked. "Mr. Ringman gets to go home." Dad said, "Mr. Ringman quit." Boy, his expression was hard to read. Then, "Sweet, it's all right." "Don't know." Because she teared up and was leaning toward him, about to fling her arms round his waist. He glanced at me, alarmed. Did I mention his clothes? So up I stepped, and Swede laid her head against my chest to cry while I held ungracefully onto her, and Dad's washed hand smoothed her hair and shielded her face and blessed her, it seemed to me, against all coming trouble. Of note, I think, is that Roofing Elementary actually had a contract with a pipe and furnace man in Montrose in order to deal with just such catastrophes. His name was Jack Benedict, and he was accompanied always by a big and fractionally tamed raccoon, Roach, who would tangle his leash around your ankles and then bite you when you tried to unwrap him. Jack Benedict had paid many a slippery visit to Roofing Elementary, including the time Roger Capps, who would later join the Army and die falling out of a helicopter, snagged his teacher's wig off her head in a fire drill and zigzagged with it through the crowded hall, finding sanctuary in the boys' washroom, whence was heard the inevitable flush. Not to lose my point here, the school had no compunction about calling on Jack Benedict until Superintendent Holgren decided Dad's teeth needed scouring. As far as I was concerned, Mr. Ringman had the right idea. But Dad just bent to work, firing up a wide-mouth pump that sucked with a repellent sound and coughed organic matter through a window into a parked truck. He dismantled the furnace, cleaned it piece by piece. He mopped and disinfected, his fingers and lungs corroding from borax. His lack of complaint must have provoked Superintendent Holgren, who came to our house after Dad finished up. It was 8 in the evening. Dad was in the tub with his head on a rolled towel. Holgren clomped up the porch and knocked hard. I opened the door and stood there. He wasn't coming in, short of pushing me physically. "Evening, Mr. Holgren." I hated him, I'll admit, and would soon hate him more, but a person had to feel sorry about his face. I don't know if you've ever tried a dish called tomato pudding. It's cooked soft and is ever so red and lumpy. He said, "Your dad here?" "He's taking a bath." I stayed put. Seeing Holgren come up the steps, Swede had run to her room. Now, faintly, I heard her call.
"Did a skunk walk through our yard? Pee, you!"
"Well, tell him something from me." Holgren was angry, but thought I couldn't discern it. He was one of those people who believes all kids have blunted senses. "I bet he's forgot the parent-teacher meetings tomorrow night. He spent so much time cleaning up his basement mess, he never swept the classrooms for 2 days now. He'll have to get to it before school tomorrow. Tell him I said to come in early." "Good night, Mr. Holgren," I said. From her room, Swede hollered,
"Oh, it's getting worse. Awful, awful."
But Holgren didn't get it. There was nothing in his eyes but spite. So home we stayed, Swede and I, for one more week. The lawyer, Thomas de Cuellar, came by several times. He said little to us about his hours spent with Davy, though he later remarked he'd never represented anyone so unconcerned with his own defense. Patient enough in telling the facts, Davy balked at attempts to place him in too kind a light. Mr. de Cuellar saw the shootings as a clear and winnable self-defense in which Davy's hand was forced to violence, a rhetoric that displeased my brother. He was not forced, he told Mr. de Cuellar. If he hadn't wanted to shoot those fellows, he wouldn't have done it. To say otherwise suggested he, Davy, was not in control of his actions. Mr. de Cuellar suggested we are all forced at times. We are none of us wholly our own masters. Otherwise, why couldn't Davy simply leave his cell, walk out a free man? And Davy, who could be contrary, replied, "Well, maybe I will." Nor could Mr. de Cuellar raise in Davy a suitably dramatic remorse. Though Davy allowed he felt bad, about Tommy especially, he couldn't see what this had to do with his defense. Mr. de Cuellar said the court was sometimes inclined to mercy toward the contrite, to which Davy replied, if contrition meant a soul felt repentance born of wrongdoing, then it had yet to kick in. Poor Mr. de Cuellar. Even his petition to have Davy tried as a juvenile was slapped down, a decision that brought a few more calls from reporters who wanted reaction from the family. Speaking for myself, the notion of Davy as a juvenile never made sense anyway. 16 or not, Davy was an adult, and had been for a long time. Swede, meantime, sat in her room, whacking at the typewriter and occasionally banging her palm on the wall in frustration. This went on for hours. It was unnerving. One afternoon, I went out to shoot baskets at the wire hoop we'd bolted to the garage and was startled to see Dr. Animus Noakes standing at attention outside Swede's bedroom window. He was carrying a sack that I knew by now would contain a loaf of Mrs. Noakes' onion bread and, with luck, also a pie. Seeing me, he motioned for quiet and I went and stood with him. Swede's window shade was pulled, and strange noises issued from behind it. Typewriter keys, yes, but also a sort of desperate chant. Swede's own voice, rendered distant and tribal, searching for meter. Dr. Noakes looked a question at me. "Doggone poem has given her trouble," I said. I felt pretty resentful about it. We weren't at school, after all. A lot of good free time was going down the drain.
"Ah," said Dr. Noakes, as if some great mist had parted. Then, "Reuben, you look like a boy who knows how to treat a pecan pie."
That same night, I remember because the pie was still very much with me, Swede showed up in my room dragging her sleeping bag. It was one of those cheapies with a vinyl shell, and I heard it crinkling all the way from the hall closet. She opened the door and pulled it in after her, vinyl and mold smell entering too. And she spread it on Davy's bed and snaked down into it and thumped Davy's pillow until it was comfortable and she was sure I was awake. I whispered, "Hi, Swede," not caring a bit that I sounded overjoyed to see her. I was overjoyed. She'd been grousing in her room for days, and I'd started to wonder, had I made some grave mistake?
"Reuben, can I sleep in here?"
"Sure." There wasn't much moon. All I could see of her looked like a white kitten crouched on the pillow.
"From now on," she said, "till Davy gets back."
The white kitten leapt and hovered. Swede had sat up.
"Reuben, you really think he'll come back at all?"
Now that was one of the worst questions I'd ever been asked. Out of nowhere, my throat lumped. I kept still to stop anything else happening.
"Reuben?"
But I couldn't talk about Davy right then. It made me cross how close I was to crying. A grouchiness emerged, which was no small relief.
"How come you been in your room so much anyhow? Don't you know others of us live here?"
She was quiet a moment, during which I regretted being harsh. Then she said,
"Well, I'll tell you about it if you want, you grump."
I sure had missed my sister. What happened to Swede, which I'll admit didn't make a lot of sense to me at the time, was that she couldn't kill Valdez. That is, Sunny Sundown couldn't kill him. Bear with me. After Finch and Bosca grabbed Swede that day, you might recall old Sonny's adventures turned a little grim. Remember how he kept trailing along after Valdez, finding worse and worse?
"One day an upturned stagecoach and its driver's ghastly hue, the next a blackened farmhouse and its family blackened too."
The day Swede sat me down and read me those lines, I began to understand how truly scared she'd been. Till then, I'd been picturing Valdez as one of those banditos in Zorro, sitting a scrawny horse, sneaky grin and eyebrows, the kind of villain who'd dig for earwax to groom his mustache. And you know, I'd liked him that way. Sly, nasty, but certainly no match for any hero worth the name. Now, overnight, Valdez had come unbound. He'd grown, personally. He was a monster. I worried that real damage had been done to Swede. Something that might plague her, not for weeks, but years. I imagined her at 25, hair gone white, skinny and ulcerated, a fearsome picture. Also, it bothered me that the poem now seemed likely to turn out wrong. One thing had to happen, and soon. That pig Valdez had to die, and Sunny Sundown had to kill him, honorably and inevitably, with one shot. And Valdez had to fall down on his back and lie outstretched on the scorched earth, his eyes wide open in the noonday sun, so that we knew he was dead and not faking it. I said to Swede,
"What do you mean you can't kill him?"
"It doesn't work. I've been trying and it doesn't work. What can I do?"
She sounded a little panicked. I thought something might be happening to her mind. I said cautiously,
"Can't you think of a word to rhyme with dead?"
She didn't answer.
"I'll help you, Swede. Let me help you. How about head? Like, he got shot in the head and fell down dead. Or spread. He fell down dead with his arms outspread. Or lead. Say, lead is a natural—"
"Reuben, that's not what I mean." How quietly she interrupted. Out of respect, I judged, for the literary role I was on.
"It's not that I can't write it. I've written it already 10 ways. More than 10.
If she could write it, what was the problem?"
I sat confounded. Mistaking my silence for doubt, Swede recited, and as the gunshots echo back against the canyon walls, Valdez begins to totter. Now he staggers. Now he falls. "Yeah," I said. "Yeah." And later, Sundown finds a match and lights it with a stroke, 'cause graves and sunbaked ground come hard. A man can use a smoke. "Swede, that's great. He buries him and everything. Now what's the matter?"
She'd flop back on the pillow. So much weight my praise carried.
"Just because I write it doesn't mean it really happened."
I had to hold that in my head a while. I knew she knew what she meant. I hoped she'd assume I did, too.
She said, "It doesn't matter if it sounds good. I can't write it so he's really dead."
"You see what I mean?"
I said, "It's just a poem, Swede. Here, tell me another ending."
Heavy sigh.
"When judgment came as gunfire to determine bad from good, and Valdez lay all soaked in blood, and wary Sundown stood."
"What's wrong with that?" I demanded, though honestly I wasn't crazy about it either. I preferred the one where Sonny lit the cigarette after putting Valdez in the ground.
"It doesn't work," she declared.
"Well, you can't bargain with someone who won't sell. If she was miserable and intractable about staying so, what could I do about it? This would have been a good time for me to shut up and go to sleep, but the slow fever of jealousy had been lit in my veins. Swede was talking some language to which I knew the words but not the meanings. It scratched my pride. I tried making my voice gruff, like Davy's.
"Listen, Swede, who's running this story anyway?"
She didn't answer. She was right not to. It was a dumb old question.
When Sorrows Like Sea Billows Roll. 10 days before the start of Davy's trial, this article appeared in the Minneapolis Star. A Victim's Story. His aunt called him Bubby, because as a child nothing made him happier than sitting on her back step blowing soap bubbles that rose and drifted across the yards of this small middle American town. "I was a second mother to him," Marjorie Bosca said. "Bubby lived with me when his parents had difficulties. He was easy to have. Oh, he was sweet." Last month, on a night that brought the first bitter snow of autumn, Bubby, Thomas Bosca, age 17, was shot dead in a house across town. His parents, Stanley and Karen Bosca, have been unwilling to talk with the press about the loss of their only child. Now the child's favorite aunt has agreed to tell her story to the Star. I won't belabor you with the rest of the Star piece, beyond revealing that it vexes Swede to this day.
"It's hackneyed,"
she pronounced recently, poking through decaying clippings at my kitchen table.
"Maudlin, asinine."
Swede grew up unforgiving of journalistic convention. Yet the story had sway. It can't be denied. Looking back at how the Finch and Bosca family shunned the papers at first, cussing over chain locks at forward reporters, the timing of their turnaround seemed predestined, as all history does when you think about it. By the time Marjorie Bosca decided to talk,
"By the time she sobered up and got her house cleaned," said Swede,
"the reporters had pretty well run the string out on Davy Land's heroics and seemed cheerful at the prospect of laying him low. The Associated Press strewed the Bubby story all over Christendom, and I mean to tell you it got results. Do you think poor Mrs. Bosca could have guessed at the power of tragedy? Could she have expected the letters of warmth and sorrow that suddenly bloomed in her post office box? Could she," Swede asked cruelly,
"even read those letters?"
My sister's resentments notwithstanding, Marjorie's pitiful recital contained a certain truth that I, at least eventually, had to face. Tommy Bosca was an idiot, but he wasn't purebred evil. You could see, looking at him, that he might be somebody's Bubby. He tagged after Israel Finch because Israel Finch liked having a disciple, and no one else was witless enough to want the job. I suspect even Swede could be brought around to the truth of this. But remember, Tommy was an accomplice the night of her horrible ride. He grinned during it. Swede comes by her blind spot honestly. But the Star piece, for all its mawkishness, dropped a tasty new ingredient in the stew. Observing the public response, even Tommy's bereaved folks, Stan and Karen, patched things up long enough to pose pathetically for an AP photographer. I've got that clipping, too, by the way.
As a picture of American underprivilege, it could have won awards. You never saw people of more threadbare hopes, their eyes dust bowl flat. Remember those photographs they used to take out west of dead outlaws propped frowning in their coffins? I have a number of letters here that arrived for Davy in the days just before his trial. I'm guessing Walt Stocker didn't read these out loud. Dear Butcher, this is to let you know what I think of a person who shoots somebody that way. That Bosca kid never even owned a gun, because he didn't like killing things, not like some who will shoot anything that moves for the fun of slaughter. You're like the nasty kid who waits in shadow for the little harmless twerp to walk by on his way to school. Then you grab the twerp and whack him around a while because you like to see him scared. Well, you listen to me, Butcher. The Bible says the meek are going to inherit the earth. And when they do, every last harmless twerp will rise up emboldened, and they will join together, and they will hunt down all butchers and cast them off cliffs and into rivers until the earth is cleansed. In the meantime, I hope your trial is a great success and the judge gives you the electric chair, you butcher, or however it is done in this present day. Hang you by the neck until dead. Very sincerely. The sentiments here are representative of the new surge of mail. People love an underdog, especially a dead one, and poor Tommy made a dandy, so blank and trusting. How hideous my brother suddenly appeared to patrons of printed news, how base and small-souled. You'd have thought poor Bubby broke into our house still wearing short pants, though I'll admit the letter has some panache. This fellow really found his voice once he hit on the harmless twerp idea. That's a good phrase, rise up emboldened. It sounds like something Swede might have written. And besides, it's hard to argue against the meek turning the tables at long last. I don't blame the writer, who, from his remarks about Tommy not owning a gun, betrays the earnest influence of the Marjorie story. How could he know how wrong-headed it was? Even Davy's fellow inmate, Mighty Stinson, took delight in the sudden downturn of public opinion, lifting his head to say, "Pretty much of a hot shot, great big Davy Land." Mighty, who got no mail, was housed two cells down. A perplexed fry cook of 20, he'd hooked a lady's checkbook left behind at the cash register. The lady realized her mistake in minutes and was back to claim it. But by then, Mighty was trotting down to the First National, where he produced the checkbook and wrote one out to cash for $35. That First National was the lady's own bank, and that all three tellers on duty knew the fry cook on sight meant little or nothing to Mighty. "You're such a hot shot. Let's see you bust out of here. Bust me out, too, while you're at it," he said. All of this troubled Thomas de Cuellar. The trial, which would start Wednesday at the courthouse in Montrose, was our small world's favorite conversation by now. On Sunday night, Mr. de Cuellar sat down tiredly at our kitchen table and told us how it was. "People are placing their sympathies with the dead boys," he said. There was bread and cheese on the table, and he built a sandwich. "You wouldn't have any of those pickles left." "They're all gone. Our compliments to Mrs. de Cuellar," Dad said. "I don't understand why it matters. The jury is supposed to be impartial." Mr. de Cuellar looked at Dad, a careful look. "Oh, they are. They'll do their best. Jeremiah, have you been reading the papers this week?" I remember how long it took Dad to answer that question. Mr. de Cuellar chewed his bread and cheese. Swede and I sat quietly. I had a feeling the adults didn't know we were in the room, a feeling we were getting away with something, and a sadness that it was nothing to be prized. "I've read them," Dad said. "You have to assume the jury has also. Of course, they'll be sequestered once the trial starts. Until then, they're quite free, quite at liberty." You know, Mr. de Cuellar did speak like a lawyer, but he didn't mind doing it with his mouth full of bread and cheese. He turned unexpectedly to us. "You know, compadres," using that word because Swede liked it, "the situation could be much worse. You know how they conducted trials back in Saxon England?" Swede shook her head. She liked most everything about Mr. de Cuellar, his black coffee eyes that seemed in poor light all pupil, his pipe, a small neat meerschaum he extracted now from a baggy pocket, and his way of speaking to us, which, Dad said, was in the manner of men who had wanted children for decades and never had them. "Do you remember the Battle of Hastings?" he inquired. 1066, Swede replied. "King Harold took that arrow right in the eye." Exactly, Mr. de Cuellar beamed. Well, before that, England was in Saxon hands. The Saxons invented jury trials, but they also tested for guilt by ordeal.
He said this last in a pretentious whisper while pressing sweet shredded tobacco into the bowl of his pipe. Swede hunched up.
That sounds awful.
Yes, it was. A man might point to his poor neighbor and say before the judge, "He stole my grain." Henceforth, the accused would be bound securely. "Stoke up the fire," the judge would cry out, and the poor man, having no argument spoken in his favor, would have a red-hot iron laid across his palm, or his hand would be pushed into boiling water.
"But if he was innocent," Swede protested.
Mr. de Cuellar could be ruthless on an audience. My goodness, but he loved history.
"If innocent, he would pass the test. His flesh would be unharmed."
He struck a match and drew a gob of flame down into the bowl. The tobacco glowed and settled. He said pleasantly,
"So people believed."
"Then no one ever passed," Swede observed darkly. And Mr. de Cuellar replied,
"It's recorded some did pass. Some men accused of murder and theft were tried this way and left unscarred."
He looked at Dad.
"Probably not many, Jeremiah?"
Dad said, "Maybe, Tom, you ought to tell us what we can expect of the trial, how it all works."
"Yes, of course. It's quite simple."
And Mr. de Cuellar spoke a brief, clear paragraph about the properties of justice, about the efforts the prosecution would surely make to discredit our brother and portray him as a brutish reprobate, and finally, as if to cancel budding doubts, about Davy's brave defense of us, his family. A most heroic act, he said, as anyone could see. When Mr. de Cuellar stood to go, Swede rose also and hugged him hard around the waist. I recall that before leaving, Mr. de Cuellar offered Dad 2 counts of advice for the coming days. First, maintain a happy composure at work. Second, answer no questions, especially from reporters. We were to stay out of the newspapers, which, he said, had never really seen the problem with Saxon justice. Good advice is a wise man's friend, of course, but sometimes it just flies on past, and all you can do is wave. Because the next day, speaking of ordeals, Dad went and got himself fired by Mr. Holgren, with half the school looking. Honestly, I hate to even tell you this part. Who wants to hear a story that's nothing but misfortune? All the same, there's a detail or two it'd be improper to leave out. And anyway, Dad didn't have a whole lot of himself invested in the janitorial field. You don't have to worry about his self-respect, is what I'm saying, though you might light a candle for Mr. Holgren's, if you're that sort of person. It transpired in the cafeteria of Roofing Elementary. Several classes, mine included, were assembled for the morning milk break. Because of impending Thanksgiving, we all had on pilgrim hats cut from stiff black paper. And Mrs. Bushka, downtown at the bakery, had sent over some gingerbread turkeys, bedecked with orange and yellow frosting. You can imagine what a treat these were, especially juxtaposed against our general feelings toward the cafeteria. Even as we sat, prying lids off milk bottles, we could hear the persecuted cooks banging around back in the kitchen, grandmas barking at each other, preparing the daily grotesque. I remember Peter Emerson predicting meatloaf for that day's lunch, Peter looking uncharacteristically solemn because of his pilgrim hat, explaining his logic. "The butcher's truck goes to the dump every Thursday. This smells like the dump Fridays." It was nonetheless a glad-hearted gathering there in the cafeteria, at least until Mr. Holgren came down to make some brooding remarks about Thanksgiving, probably having to do with privation and death. He'd certainly picked the right career, had Mr. Holgren. His every feature spoke of resentment and annoyance, and to people under 5 feet tall, of physical danger. His poor face looked always festering with some imminent parasitical hatch. Nothing could quiet a happy crowd of kids like Mr. Holgren's unannounced appearance. He loved superintending. He was made for it. So when he marched in that morning with a determined grin on his face, we froze. Boys and girls recognize sinister as handily as dogs do. Here it was. My best guess now is he got it in his head to try relating to us. But when he produced a paper pilgrim's hat from behind his back and put it on his own head, I think we all nearly bolted.
I had a nightmare once in which the devil entered my room and opened my closet and started trying on my clothes. This was similar. Mr. Holgren stood there with his mouth grinning and his eyes in some sort of torment, and the pilgrim hat. Well, I'd actually thought those handmade hats were pretty neat until the superintendent donned his. Suddenly, they seemed repulsive, and I reached up and took mine off. Then Mr. Holgren said his few words. I've forgotten them. Doesn't matter. No doubt he thought we were all spellbound, and that he was giving Miss Carlin and the other teachers present a fine lesson in captivating school children. What had my attention, though, was something I hadn't noticed before. I'd been so transfixed by Mr. Holgren's strange manner, I hadn't seen the neatly scripted letters near the squared-off top of his hat. Very small capitals and white chalk, easy to miss, but really quite readable. "Shoot me," they said, in letters so smoothly drafted Miss Carlin herself might have written them. Well, I saw that and wanted to laugh. Not just wanted to. I tell you, that laugh was down in my stomach like bad beef. It meant to come out. Desperately, I strove for placid thoughts, which meant, of course, not looking at Mr. Holgren's hat, not thinking those words, and yet they called, like a summons, like a hissed invitation. Shoot me! Calling to the laugh inside my belly. You want torture? A giggle crept up the old esophagus. I swallowed it down. My eyeballs watered. The worst of it was, I seemed to be the only kid who'd noticed. Either that, or everyone else had iron control. A terrible thought. I looked around. Glazed faces everywhere. No one else had seen. Oh, but that moment was a lonesome place. Mr. Holgren talked on. I molared the inside of my cheek. The laugh stayed put, but I felt it down there, accruing strength. Goodness, it made me nervous. I chanced to look at Mr. Holgren. Shoot me, plain as day. I swallowed about 12 times. Then Peter Emerson leaned over to my ear. Bang, he whispered. I knew defeat. Through mouth-plastered hands, the laugh ripped forth. A ruddy bray that condemned me to the stares of aghast pilgrims. And who knew what violent repercussions at the hands of Mr. Holgren? I laughed so hard my sight went dark. I laid my forehead down on the table to sob. Did anyone laugh with me? Who knows? I do remember it felt solitary as the wave rolled off, and I remember looking up through tears to see the glaring superintendent, Death in a hat, shoot me, still writ upon his mighty crown. And I remember wishing I could arrange to be shot at that moment and have it done with. It occurs to me now that I have no idea what became of Superintendent Holgren. Is he somewhere alive yet, a distressed old man in suspendered baggies, fixing his nightly suppers from tin cans, fearing his own reflection? Or did his conscience take pity and kill him early on, as Swede suggested might be just? Well, he didn't kill me. Though I don't doubt his intention. It was his very eagerness to reach me that wrecked his day, because he started for me, all right, but was so anxious about it, he clipped his thigh rounding the table. Do you remember how tippy those milk bottles were? Struck by more than a sidelong glance, they'd whirl and spill. Mr. Holgren took that corner in the meat of the thigh, and half a dozen of the little soldiers leapt from the tabletop and burst wondrously at our feet. That froze Mr. Holgren. And just as he was about to do some real superintending, too. The cafeteria was silent, except for the contents of one tipped bottle streaming off the table to the floor. A lonely bathroom sound. Beside me, Peter Emerson, feeling left out because his bottle had stopped just short of the edge, moved his elbow furtively. The bottle tipped, sailed out, exploded. "Ah!" Peter said aloud. He was the happiest kid I ever knew. And then, as would happen, Dad appeared. Instinctively, I feared for him, for a curse seemed hovering in that room. And I'll admit I feared for myself as well. I owned a bit of rotten pride in those days that recoiled at the sight of Dad in coveralls. It didn't seem fair, you understand. I knew Dad was the smartest, best-hearted, most capable man in any room he occupied. Knew, too, that he was beloved by God, that whatever he touched was apt to prosper.
sometimes in mighty and inexplicable style. To see him, therefore, in janitor clothes seemed to me the result of a strange and discomforting arithmetic. How could it be that his boss was a man like Mr. Holgren, who Swede called Chester the Fester on account of his face, a man who treated Dad with futile contempt, who talked about scouring Dad's teeth? And this bothered me, too. Dad would come into a room, pushing his broom, and always some dumb kid would turn to me and smirk. Janitor's kid? Mop jockey? Clean up any good puke lately? I'm sorry if you thought better of me, but the fact is I spent whole hours imagining alarming humiliations for those kids. Big, dumb kids, always, with effortless all-star lungs. Oh, yes, and hours spent thus were not bitter, but passed like joyous dreams, in which Bethany Orchard always chanced along to see the dumb kids at their most abject. It's true, no grudge ever had a better nurse. But Dad was in his usual fine humor that day in the cafeteria, diagnosing the breakage, catching my eye and Peter's as we watched from our benches and sending us a wink. His face betrayed delight, for he'd entered at the moment of Chester's fabulous lurch. It took him perhaps 20 seconds to gauge the damage, unlock a supply closet, and set to work with a rag mop and bucket. And in that time, Mr. Holgren saw before him an opportunity to set an example, to superintend, to scour. As Dad knelt for broken glass, Holgren stepped up next to him so that Dad was working around his knees. He looked slave-like down there, bending for bits of bottle as Holgren stood, hands on hips, dissatisfied as Legree. I could barely watch. Behind me, Miss Carlin encouraged the class to finish our gingerbread, but the kids sat bewitched. Something horrible was happening. I looked at Mr. Holgren, whose hat was off now. He was looking back at me, holding my eye, for I'd done him an outrage. At his feet, Dad worked patiently, tossing shards into a tray, finally standing and finishing up with the mop, using the rinse bucket so the whole stretch of floor was a continent of shine and good health. Mr. Holgren said, "Land, we have to talk." Dad looked at his boss, surprised by some alteration in his voice. "There have been complaints," the superintendent said. Miss Carlin said softly, "Children, we must go now." And guess what Holgren did? He held up one hand for silence, not taking his eyes off Dad. He wanted everyone there. "All right," Dad said. "Last week, when you were cleaning up your little mess down in the basement, 2 people reported you stumbling around down there, talking out loud to yourself. 2 different people came to me and said so." Dad said nothing. I didn't know what Holgren was getting at. Saying next, "This isn't the first time. I've seen it myself. Come down to the boiler room and I hear you chattering away." He spoke with quiet reason, as if Dad were some disturbed child. Oh, how I wanted to kill Holgren. I wanted him dead in his grave unkept. "Jeremiah," he said, his voice a disapproving murmur, "I'm aware you passed clean out a couple of weeks ago." "In public," Holgren said. "In church," he added most sadly, deeply concerned for the ruined dignity of the employee before him. "Don't you think your problem is getting out of hand?" he said. I entered here into some sort of shock, for I understood 3 things at once. First, that Superintendent Holgren was accusing my father of drunkenness, a charge so preposterous that God would surely flatten him before our waiting eyes. I also understood that word of the sensational Johnny Latt service had spread, and how people will apply the unkindest parts of themselves to any herd intelligence. And I understood, with my soul turning sour, that Dad would not defend himself within our hearing. I do not doubt that Holgren understood this also. Miss Carlin began quietly rallying us children to leave, in spite of the fine example being set by the administrator. Miss Carlin's slender face was a dark, displeased red, for which I ever after gave her the devotion of an ally. As we clattered up our trays, I heard Holgren demand Dad's explanation. I saw Dad lean down and voice a soft reply. At this, the superintendent made the most fitful transformation. His neck compressed into his shoulders, his hands clawed and shrunk upward into his sleeves. He stamped his foot like the maladjusted. He he was Mr. Hyde. He roared a few words, and Dad became a former janitor. Most boys, I'm guessing, have never watched outright as their father was stripped of his livelihood, and I don't want to pound it too hard, but the cruelty of that moment still impresses me. I left my milling classmates and headed for Dad, where he stood in rapt surprise facing Holgren. I hadn't in mind to say anything, and indeed I didn't, for as I approached, Dad lifted his hand, sudden as a wind shift, touched Holgren's face, and pulled away. It was the oddest little slap you ever saw. Holgren quailed back a step, hunching defensively, but Dad turned and walked off, and the superintendent stood with his fingers strangely awonder over his chin, cheeks, and forehead. Then I saw that his bedeviled complexion, that face set always at a rolling boil, had changed. I saw instead skin of a healthy tan, a hale blush spread over cheekbones that suddenly held definition. Above his eyes, the shine of constant seepage had vanished, and light lay at rest upon his brow. Listen, there are easier things than witnessing a miracle of God. For his part, Mr. Holgren didn't know what to make of it. He looked horrified. The new piece in his hide didn't sink deep. He covered his face from view and slunk from the cafeteria. I knew what had happened, though. I knew exactly what to make of it, and it made me mad enough to spit. What business had Dad in healing that man? What right had Holgren to cross paths with the great God Almighty? The injustice took my breath away. Truly it did. I felt a great hand close against my lungs, and Miss Carlin escorted me gasping to the nurse's office, where Miss Beulah plugged in her teapot and made a steam tent from a bolt of tan canvas. When Dad came to take me home, having boxed up the contents of his single drawer in the boiler room, I wouldn't go with him. I stayed on Mrs. Beulah's couch. Dad lifted a corner of the canvas and peeked under. "Looks like I'm getting a little vacation," he said. I nodded. "I'm sorry you saw that." His getting fired, he meant, not the other thing. "How about we go home?" But I shook my head. I just couldn't go with him. Nor could I tell him it wasn't his public mistreatment that stole my breath and blocked my tongue. It was something too mean to explain. It was the fact that Chester the Fester, the worst man I'd ever seen, even worse in his way than Israel Finch, got a whole new face to look out of and didn't even know to be grateful, while I, my father's son, had to be still and resolute and breathe steam to stay alive. Late in the night when the fires are out. Early Wednesday, under red skies, we drove to Montrose for Davy's trial. We'd been told to be at the courthouse at 9 a.m., but the DeQuayers insisted we breakfast at their house at 7:30. There's no way a person can really prepare for someone like Mrs. DeQuayer, buxom and businesslike on her doorstep. Once she had you inside, she became the woman you wished had lived next door all the days of your childhood. She was short, round, bright. At the age when most women begin putting up their hair, she wore hers long for beauty, and it was beautiful. Black and woolly, her very own buffalo robe. She had turquoise earrings and crisp metallic perfume. Helping Swede off with her coat, she knelt and put her cheek to Swede's and held it there a moment before getting up. Then she said, "Breakfast's ready, sweet ones," and marched us to the kitchen. It was fitting, that march. There was something about Mrs. DeQuayer that reminded you of a bass drum. And breakfast? What would you say to butter-crumbed eggs that trembled at the touch of your fork, to buttermilk biscuits under tumbling steam, to orange sides of salmon lying creamed upon blue saucers? What would you say to fresh peach pie, baked not the night before, but that very morning? For breakfast? And through everything, Mrs. DeQuayer, like a small son beside her proud and outshone husband, beamed down on Swede and me. It seemed, honestly, like a mistake. I couldn't remember ever being so easily liked. Thus braced against the evil of the day, we went to the courthouse. We thought to visit Davy before it all started, but were informed this was impossible, and advised to wait on the benches in the hall until the jury was seated and given instructions. "What instructions?" Swede wanted to know. "Listen carefully?" In fact, I've learned, trials are mostly a succession of waits. When the benches became restrictive, we up and bushwhacked around the big hall.
We waited all morning, when others began to arrive, including some newspaper men of our acquaintance. A clerk came and asked if we'd like to wait in a separate office, the three of us. We were glad to. A whiskery, yellow-eyed old man was sitting on the neighboring bench. A reporter sat with him, calling him Mr. Finch. The old man didn't answer. His hands shook. He had those thirsty fingers. Stan and Karen Boska stood in uneasy conference by the water fountain. Stan's sister Marjorie, the famous aunt, had just hove into view down the hall. We followed the clerk to a barren office with a long table acrawl with cigarette burns, and a few minutes later in stepped Mr. De Cuellar to say it would be a bit longer. The prosecuting attorney, whom I remember only by his first name, Elvis, had detected an attitude problem in one of the jurors. "Will it be a long time?" Sweet asked, not a hint of wine in the question. She liked Mr. De Cuellar that much. He looked at her, brought out his meerschaum, and squatted comfortably. Lighting the pipe, he said, "Tell me, Sweet, who in your family is champion in war at sea?" Sweet blinked, and Mr. De Cuellar slipped a notebook from his pocket, saying, "You've grown up so big not knowing how to play war at sea? I don't believe it. Here." It is thus I most often remember that good lawyer, he sitting slouched in a folding chair, notebook on his knee, Swede leaning into him as he pointed and strategized, the pants of his brown suit bagging at the ankles. We played war at sea right up through noon, Swede and I, and then, just when I'd hit on a pattern for locating and destroying her fleet, the door opened, and it was Mr. De Cuellar again, and the trial was about to commence. You've seen courtrooms. This one had dark wainscoting all around and a raised jury box fenced by a brass rail, and after we'd all stood up and sat again, it had Judge Raster, whom I'd pictured as some predatory deep-sea critter sitting behind his high desk. In the flesh, the judge had the kind of wavy white hair I associated with benevolence, the hair of soft-touch ants who keep mints and candy dishes within your reach, though his eyes, behind half-glasses, evoked no such hopeful impressions. Surprisingly, my first sense of Judge Raster was of a man who clung to small vanities. He had a preening look. You don't like to think it of a judge. Davy was in the front pew beside Mr. De Cuellar. I was surprised what a short and unrakish figure he cut. You play these things in your mind beforehand, you know, and somehow Davy's entrance into that crowded courtroom, this boy so much interpreted, the silent and notorious Davy Land, was always accompanied in my thoughts by an odd hush and perhaps a thud or two as young women, glimpsing him, fainted away. In real life, nobody seemed to be looking at him. He had on khaki pants, a chambray shirt. He needed a shave and looked to have dropped some pounds. I wanted to run forward and make him look into my eyes. After certain formalities, Elvis, the prosecutor, rose to get things started. He cleared his throat and preached an eloquent and transparent sermon on violence, a 5-minute redaction in which Davy ceased being any human being's brother and became an icy double murderer who forefigured not only his crimes, but how those crimes would